You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, whatever it may be for you. Happy Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to our newest affiliates this week, carrying our program KSOW in Oregon, KDKO in South Dakota, making that our 39th state. We have radio stations in, and also to LynnCam TV in Lynn, Massachusetts. So thank you very much for playing our program. And, of course, it being Friday, it is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls for an hour in our national town hall meeting. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. There is a lot going on in the United States Senate right now. You want to give us an update on what's happening?
I walked into my office in Washington, took a plane from Burlington Monday afternoon, walked in the evening, and kind of didn't walk out until 10 o'clock last night. So there's just a ton of stuff that's happening. And let me very briefly review some of it.
Sure.
The good news is that in recent weeks, we have won two significant victories, and my office has been part of them. One is that despite tremendous pressure from the Republicans and some Democrats, the supercommittee did not reach a conclusion, did not reach a decision which resulted in the cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that many Republicans and some Democrats wanted. The calls that I got in my office were just very, very strong, and by the dozens, do not cut Social Security. When you got 50 million people who have no health insurance, do not cut Medicare and Medicaid. And fortunately, as a result of a lot of work on the part of a lot of people, the supercommittee ended up obviously not doing that and ending up not reaching a decision at all. And
this is what I call a gang of 12.
Yes, that's right. And where we go from there is, we can talk about later, how you go forward on deficit reduction in a way that's fair to the middle class. A lot of us have ideas on that, but one of the ideas that's very clear, you don't cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Number two, I voted against the payroll tax provision the president and the Democrats offered yesterday. Now, why did I do that? Do we need a tax cut for the middle class? The answer is absolutely we do. We're in the midst of a severe recession. People are hurting. People can use that middle class tax cut to pay their bills. It helps create jobs. We need it. Should it be funded in a progressive way? The answer is yes. What the Democrats were talking about is a surtax on income above $1 million. That is exactly the right approach. That's an idea, in fact, that some of us came up with 9 months ago. Now, here's the reason I voted against it. There are a lot of tax attacks on Social Security. When you cut the payroll tax in half, what you are talking about in this case is diverting $265 billion away from the Social Security Trust Fund. Second of all, when you do this for 2 years in a row, this is the second year we've cut the payroll tax, it is likely that we will continue to do it. And that means that the source of funding for Social Security in the future has been cut in half. Fourthly, what ends up happening is that while the president and some say not to worry, the government, the Treasury, is going to replenish Social Security, what you are moving toward is ending what has always been the beauty of Social Security, and that is that it is funded independently by the payroll tax, and it is not, quote-unquote, another government program. So when you make Social Security more and more dependent on general funds, it becomes another government program, and within that scenario, very likely to be cut in years to come and end up being converted into a welfare program. So what we are working on now is how do we, in fact, deliver the middle-class tax cuts that we need? How do you fund it in a progressive way, but do it in a way that does not divert hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars away from Social Security and, in fact, end the strength of Social Security as an independent program funded by the payroll tax? So that's an issue we're working very hard on. Another issue out there that we've just introduced legislation on, and it ties in with the fact that yesterday was International AIDS Day, is many people don't know that in the United States alone, there are now thousands and thousands of people who are dealing with HIV who are unable to get the help they need to get the very expensive cocktail which addresses HIV. Problem is, states are obviously under a lot of budget problems. This cocktail cost $25,000 in the United States of America. Now, here's the interesting point. The United States has done a reasonably good job in recent years in dealing with issues like AIDS and malaria in developing countries. Tom, do you know how much it costs to get a very similar, the same generic cocktail for AIDS that the United States is paying for now in the third world? In this country, it costs about $25,000. Do you know how much that cocktail, the United States is paying for that cocktail to deliver it in a third world country?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't, but I'm guessing it's probably in the hundreds.
You got it.
Yeah.
It's about $250.
Wow.
So you have now the potential, not the potential, the reality of the generic costing a tiny fraction of what the brand name costs.
In other words, this is a cash cow for the pharmaceutical companies.
Unbelievable. So here's the insanity. The United States government is now paying, roughly speaking, $250 for the cocktail to help people South Africa and elsewhere. The state of New York, the state of Vermont, is paying $25,000 for that same cocktail, doesn't have enough money, and there are people around this country unable to get the treatment. How do you deal with that issue? Well, without going into a long detail, we've introduced legislation which is fairly radical, which changes the whole nature of how we pay for the development of new drugs. We do not let companies that have a product that can save lives charge outrageous prices for that. So you get, once a product is developed, you get it to the market in a generic form a lot cheaper, and you pay for the development through a prize fund, which focuses on companies doing research for those illnesses that we most need them to do research on. But bottom line is, having gone through, we just celebrated International AIDS Day. Internationally, in the United States, we have a serious problem. The good news is that in recent years, scientists have developed drugs to go a long way to treat those. Bad news is, in this country, they're much more expensive than they should be. So that's an issue we're going to be focusing on. Talk about it later as well. Two other issues that are out there that we're working on. I also voted against yesterday the defense bill, defense authorization bill. The appropriations bill will come later. Why did I do that? Well, for a couple of reasons. Despite the fact that, thank God, we are winding down the war in Iraq and virtually all of the troops we hope and expect will be home by the end of the year, this budget continues to spend a very, very, very significant amount of money on defense. We have tripled defense spending since 1997. My understanding is that today, as a nation, we spend more on defense than the rest of the world combined. So despite the virtual winding down of the war in Iraq, bringing our troops home, we're still spending $664 billion. We're authorizing that. We'll see what the appropriations bill is. And I think that that's too much money. So I got a little bit disturbed that many of my great deficit hawk friends who think we ought to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, health care. We just can't afford to do those things. But when it comes to defense spending, hey, sky's the limit.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of defense contractor buddies who
you
are contributing
it.
To their campaigns. And
you got it.
Oh, man. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Bernie will be taking your calls in our national town hall meeting for the rest of the hour, 866-987-THOM. His website, sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I should add, Bernie's website isn't just one of those standard, hi, I'm a senator websites. It's an actual news resource. Check it out, sanders.senate.gov.
Lost working time is lost money. Every day that a workman is unemployed, or a machine is unused, or a business organization is marking time, it is a loss to the nation.
Yeah, who do you love?
Take it back to mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, just a real quick question had been posed to you about, you know, how did Democrat. Well, I think actually the concern was that the defense authorization bill has been characterized as extending the battlefield to the entire earth, making the war against terror forever, and authorizing the arrest of American citizens.
I voted against the bill. I was one of the few people in the Democratic caucus, I think, to vote against it. My main concern was that I think we were authorizing far too much money for defense at a time when we have to focus on deficit reduction and make sure that we're not cutting Social Security and LIHEAP and education and so forth. But that was another concern that I had, and that was another reason I personally voted against it. And that's about all that I can say. I did vote against the bill.
Okay. Marty in Cambridge, Mass. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. This is Marty. I wanted to ask Bernie. I have a deep concern that there's been a tremendous erosion in terms of our so-called democracy, and I can't even call it a democracy anymore, and that kind of breaks my heart. And so many people around me are heartbroken too, and very angry, and also very upset about the fact that there's a constant barrage of legislation designed, as far as I'm concerned, to suppress people's rights.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how many people around me are almost unable to function, you know, properly in their lives because of the bombardment of what's happening. And the latest being the defense authorization bill and the provision that you just spoke about. And then there's, of course, there's the Patriot Act 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And then there's the drone attacks, the assassination of American citizen, and on and on and on. And I wanted to know how we can stop this forward march towards police state.
Thanks for your question. And I would say my first response is something that Tom Hartman and I talk about a whole lot, and that is despair is not an option. These are incredibly tough times. And you've mentioned some of the reasons, the attacks on voting rights, the attacks on civil liberties. And one of the issues out there, which is just an outrage beyond outrage, is that you have many of these Republican states now that are bending over backwards trying to suppress voting rights. They're doing everything they can to say to poor people, to elderly people, to minorities, hey, don't vote. We don't want you to vote. We're going to make it as difficult as we possibly can. And we're working on that issue. We hope the Obama administration becomes a little bit more aggressive. We're talking about voter IDs, just making it more difficult for people to register. A friend of mine in Florida told me that the League of Women Voters there is no longer registering voters because the state has made it very difficult, a lot of fines if you don't do this, that, and the other thing. So a good organization like the League of Women Voters saying, hey, we can't afford to do that. Can't afford to pay these outrageous fines. So there's been a massive attack. But having said that, Marty, you can't and should not get that discouraged, because what's going on in this country, and this is very good news, is clearly the trend is against right-wing extremism. So if I were a Republican today, I would not be a happy camper. Every poll that I have seen says the American people do not agree with more and more tax breaks for billionaires and cuts in programs that working families need. People are increasingly concerned about the growing wealth and income inequality in America. They are catching on. And Occupy Wall Street movement has played a good role in that. Last month on Election Day in Ohio, working people came together to win not only a huge victory, a landslide victory, against their governor and the attacks on the rights of working people, public employees to engage in collective bargaining, but it was more than that. It was people standing up, coming together, and saying, wait a minute, we just cannot continue to attack the middle class and working class of this country. So, Marty, believe me, now is not the time to throw in the towel. Now is the time to get more active than you've ever been. Because I think the movement that we are seeing right now is saying enough is enough with right-wing extremism. We've got to create millions of good-paying jobs in this country. We need to do deficit reduction in a way that does not attack the most vulnerable people in this country. So, Marty, I would not be quite as pessimistic as you seem to be.
Judy in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, this is Judy. Am I on the air?
You are, Judy.
Oh, hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, we've been experiencing what I think is a fake shortage of medications, and I think it has to do with money. And when, how are we going to be sure that if you get your bill through and AIDS drugs and other drugs are less expensive, that they're just going to say, hey, it's not worth it for us to make them anymore?
Good question.
You know, and then they just won't become, they won't be available.
Well, here's what we got. I don't want to spend too much time on it. It's an issue we've looked at for many, many years. Number one, in the United States, everybody should know, we end up paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. I remember a number of years ago, as Vermont's then congressman, I took a number of women over the Canadian border, which is an hour away from where I live, and they were able to get a breast cancer drug for one-tenth the price they were paying in the United States. Number two, a lot of the research and development that takes place within the pharmaceutical industry, you know, these guys say, we spend billions of dollars on research and development. Well, it's true. But a lot of that money goes into what's called Me Too drugs, not really developing a new drug to treat a serious illness, but to come up with a modest modification of a drug that is already working. Tom, I guess we'll pick this up after the break.
That's fine, Bernie. Yep.
Okay.
And so we're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Coming up on 28 minutes past the hour, our national town hall meeting where you can talk with Senator Sanders and ask him a question. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. It is an incredible resource, and you can subscribe to his newsletter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The newsletter is called The Bernie Buzz, and it has a lot of great information. Plus, as I said, his website at sanders.senate.gov is a great news resource.
Taxes shall be levied according to ability to pay. That is the only American principle.
Tax the rich, feed the poor, tell there are no rich no more.
It's Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Ever, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. And Bernie, you want to finish up answering
I just want to finish up Judy's question on prescription drugs. Bottom line here, Judy, is right now we have drugs that can be manufactured very inexpensively, generically, at a fraction of the cost of what the brand name product costs. And large numbers of people all over the world, including the United States, are dying because they can't get those medicines. And it just seems to me to be very wrong to say to somebody, you have to pay $25,000 for, say, an AIDS cocktail treatment that is available for a couple of $100s, and I'm sorry, you may have to die or suffer because we can't lower the price. That's wrong. So what we are trying to do is motivate and say to these drug companies, you can make a whole lot of money. You can make money when you produce products that really do improve health, that end diseases, that impact people, but you're not going to make a whole lot of money simply by coming up with Me Too drugs, which are modest variations on existing drugs. So it's a long discussion there, but I think we need to spend a lot of time figuring out how we can fund research and development for new drugs in a way that really results in the alleviation of the terrible illnesses that we see all over the world.
Okay. Bernie, just FYI, we've lost your video on Skype, so if you can just see your video, people know there, they can reconnect with us.
Okay.
But we still, people can still hear you. It's just fine. We're just holding a picture
we'll
of you. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are, sir.
Hey, it's Joe from Pittsburgh. Hey, I agree with you on that payroll tax extension vote. I think the Republicans are just trying to actually deplete the Social Security trust fund, and then they can create a two-tier system or possibly even eliminate Social Security. But my idea is, and it probably never gets through any Republicans, why don't we subsidize why don't we increase the Social Security ceiling for the amount of money we would lose on the lower paying people by having the the holiday.
Well, I'll tell you what I think, Joe. Here's what I agree with the first part of your assertion. Look, everybody understands there are massive, massive coordinated attacks against Social Security. Literally, there are billions of dollars out there trying to convince people that Social Security is not going to be there for them. Social Security, which in fact has not caused one nickel of our deficit, or is responsible for the deficit. We've got to cut it. Social Security is just IOUs, et cetera, whole lot of attacks on it. So what I agree with what Joe is saying in the sense that if you divert hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars away from the Social Security Trust Fund, it's going to make the Republican argument easier. And here's the other concern that I have. When you do this payroll tax holiday 2 years in a row, it eventually becomes permanent. It's going to be harder and harder for Congress to say, let's end it. So what my view is, Joe, and what we're working on, is we need more money into the Social Security Trust Fund, not less. That's why I've introduced legislation that now has, I believe, 9 co-sponsors. And in fact, Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, just came on board this week. I think he's the 10th, saying that we have to lift the cap on taxable Social Security income. Right now, if you're making $110,000, you contribute the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund as you do if you're making $1 million. That's wrong. So that's the way to go, in my view, not cut Social Security, not cut the payroll tax in half.
Okay. Sharon in Lacyville, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. I have been reading about the secret loans that the Fed made to the banks.
Yep.
And I wonder if you could clarify something. Who authorized these loans? Was it the Fed did it itself, or did Congress give the okay? And also, I've read that the loans were in the form of credit, but you still have to have assets backing the credit. So I wonder, were these assets in the form of government guarantees, or does the Fed actually have as much as $15 trillion squirreled away somewhere?
I doubt that they have $15 trillion in the basement of the Fed. Sharon, thanks very much for your question. I don't know that I know all of the answers, but this is what I do know. Number one, we introduced a provision in the Dodd-Frank bill, which for the first time did an audit of the Fed during the financial crisis, during that 3-year period. And what we learned in terms of a revolving loan, is that something like $16 trillion was lent out and came back and lent out and came back. It went to every major financial institution in the country, all the big banks. It went to some major corporations like General Electric, went to, in fact, wealthy individuals. It went to central banks all over the world. Now you ask, who authorized this? Was it the Congress? And the answer is no, it was not the Congress. All of the attention during that period, Sharon, you remember, was on the TARP fund, which was authorized by the Congress. That was what we called the Wall Street bailout. That was between $700 and $800 billion. Everyone was paying attention to that. I voted against that. But more important is what you're talking about was these secret loans that went out. So they were not authorized by the United States Congress. And that is one of the reasons why right now I am working with a number of economists to come up with Fed reform. Because the truth is that the Fed is, A, very secretive agency, and B, when you're talking about lending out trillions and trillions of dollars to include central banks all over the world, man, this is a lot of power resting in an unelected group of people. So some of your more detailed questions I can't answer. They, I don't believe, have $16 trillion in the basement of the Fed. But this is complicated, high finance, which takes us to a whole other area that needs to be opened up for public discussion and I think needs to be brought, needs some significant change. Bottom line is, what we need is a Fed which is functioning on how you grow our productive economy, how you create real jobs, rather than simply protecting large financial institutions.
Amen. Jim in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hey, Jim, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hello. All this talk about Grover Norquist's pledge, you know, people saying that, the whole idea is all those minions are against raising taxes of any kind. Well, I'm sure that they love to beat their taxes for the billionaires and the corporations. But I think that the end game here really is to bust the budget, is to break the government, you know, like he said, to drown it in the bathtub. I think the whole point is to bust the butt, you know, like Jude Wininsky's thing about the two Santas. If we spend enough money and waste enough money, there won't be anything left for the people then. And then they can wave their hands in the air and say, oh, we're broke. We can't afford Social Security. We can't afford any of this stuff. We can only fund wars from now on.
Jim, I think you make a very good point. And I think, Tom, you remember, what was Norquist's very famous line that he wants to reduce the size of government to something you could put in a bathtub and then drown it, or something to that effect?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I think Jim's point is a good point. And here's the answer. If you are serious, do I believe that deficit reduction, that a $15 trillion national debt is a real issue? I do. A $1.3 trillion deficit is a real issue? It is. But for my right-wing Republican friends, how can you tell me that you're serious about deficit reduction and then say, oh, we have to give more tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. We have to increase military spending. We don't want to plug the huge loopholes that exist for profitable corporations who in some cases make billions in a year and pay nothing in taxes. We don't want to deal with the revenue issue such that as part of GDP, revenue in the United States is the lowest that it has been in decades. We don't really care about that. And I think Jim's point is right. Look, from a philosophical point of view, going back many, many, many decades, what these guys believe is that a relatively small number of very wealthy and powerful people should control the economic and political life of this country. And they want to repeal all of the successful pieces of legislation that have been passed in the last 80 years to give the middle class and working people some stability and some basic rights. That means ending Social Security. Why do we need Social Security? You can invest in Wall Street and get some kind of retirement plan there that will make money for our friends on Wall Street. Why do you need Medicare and Medicaid? You can have some private insurance company providing you with health insurance. Why do you need workers' protection on the job through OSHA? Why do you need an EPA that regulates corporate pollution? You don't need those things. You don't need those things. Let's go back to the 1920s. Let's go back to an oligarchic form of society. So I think Jim's point is very well taken. I think it has basically very much to do with what their agenda is about.
Yeah. And, of course, all your statements just a moment ago were sarcastic.
Yes.
Lest anybody try to take them out of context. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. It's a great resource, and ours is at TomHartman.com. Not too shabby either.
Not only our future economic soundness, but the very soundness of our democratic institutions depends on the determination of our government to give employment to idle men.
When I hear the music play and I hear the children sing, I know together in a thing it's possible.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Our Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. George in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom and Senator Sanders. Can you hear me?
Hear you fine, George.
My question is, I'm wondering what you think of this movement to amend the U.S. Constitution to abolish corporate personhood. Do you think it's really possible, and how much would it be helpful? And I just want to say I'm an active member of Occupy Grand Rapids, Michigan, as I have been since its beginning 2 months ago.
Well, George, let me say this. Interesting that you asked that question. We are probably going to be circulating what's called in Washington a dear colleague today about a constitutional amendment that we are going to bring forth that does just that. Supreme Court 5-4 decision of a couple of years ago, stating the totally insane point of view that nobody outside of, I suppose, the Supreme Court believes to be true, that a corporation is a person, is entitled to First Amendment rights, can spend as much money as they want on a campaign under the guise of First Amendment rights. I don't think very many people believe that. I'm not a great fan of constitutional amendments. You know, we got a very good document that has worked well for over 200 years. I don't want to see it amended every other day. But I think on an issue as important as this, we have to say very loudly and clearly, a corporation is not a person, that we perceive what is absolutely the case, that if you allow these powerful, wealthy corporations to be able to pour hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, into political campaigns, this moves us very much away from the kind of democracy that most of us believe in, to really an oligarchy, where people sitting around the room in secret, without disclosure, can just bombard the airwaves all over this country and elect or unelect those people who they want. That very serious danger to democracy. So we are going to be introducing a constitutional amendment. There are a couple of other good amendments out there. We think ours maybe goes a little bit further, which begins to address this issue.
Great. Patty in Lula, Georgia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon and honor, sirs. I would have one quick question. Who gave Grover Norquist such power and such a hold over Congress that he can make so many people so miserable?
Well, in fairness to Grover Norquist, he is a very good political organizer. And what he has done is rallied his right-wing base to say that any member of, first of all, to put pressure on them to sign a pledge that there will be no tax increases on the wealthy, and second of all, to rally his base to put pressure on any member who is thinking about retreating from that position. Now, what we can learn from Grover Norquist is here is a guy who is defending an unpopular position. Most of Americans believe that the wealthiest people in this country should start paying their fair share of taxes. Most Americans are outraged at a situation where you have the 400 wealthiest people in this country owning more wealth than the bottom one-half of America, 150 million people. So Norquist is very much in a minority, but he has a whole lot of power. And I think what we have to be thinking about is how do we hold elected officials accountable to say, you know what, start standing up for the 99%. Start standing up for working people. Start standing up for the environment. Start standing up for jobs. And if you don't, guess what? You're going to be in trouble. So there's a lesson to be learned from Norquist, who's a very good politician, and that is rallying, you know, large numbers of people to start putting pressure and getting deeply involved in the political process.
Charles in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Sanders. Senator, I'd like you to propose a bill that would reinstate the consumer interest tax deduction. You know, you're probably too young to remember this, but there was a time during the Reagan years where, before Reagan, where, you know, when we bought a car or used our credit card, we could write off the interest.
Huh.
And if you reinstate that, that would help out millions of Americans. It would help out the consumers and the business owners.
Well, Charles, to be honest with you, not anything. I thank you for the compliment of being so young that I can't remember it. But it's not something that I have thought about. But bottom line is, through tax policy, and I can't comment on your particular idea, we certainly are going to have to protect the middle class and help the middle class expand and stimulate the economy. So I'll take your idea under advisement and take a look at it.
Lingy in Portsmouth, Arkansas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Listen, Coco, it's me. Hello.
Okay. I'm sorry. Jacob just said next call. I'm not sure why. Glenn in Ogden, Utah. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. I applaud your vote on the payroll tax cut. Here's my question. Back in the Bush administration, we had a crisis that came up. What it was elderly people were being forced to choose between cat food and prescription drugs. What came out of that was that all elderly people would get a benefit.
Glenn, we have just a minute until the end of the show. Quick question.
Some of those folks are very wealthy. Should not we be able to use those elderly who are very well off, very wealthy, in a negotiation about reduction in spending versus revenue.
So you want a means test Medicare then, I guess.
I wouldn't, Glenn, I do understand where you're coming from. I wouldn't go in that direction. I think once you start breaking what we call the universality of programs, Social Security or Medicare, over a period of time, you know, you can start off today, hey, nobody over $1 million should get Medicare. Well, that sounds fine. Who cares? That's okay. Mark my words. Next year, it's $500,000. 3 years from now, it's $50,000. And 5 years from now, you got a welfare program. The real solution is to say that the wealthiest people in this country, whether you're elderly or not, have got to pay their fair share of taxes in order to sustain the important social safety net programs that protect the lives of tens of millions of Americans.
So very well said. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Up next, Jack Abramoff. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, Jack Abramoff, the former lobbyist, author of a new book, Capital Punishment. Capital with an O, as in the capital of the United States. Capital Punishment, the hard truth about Washington corruption from America's most notorious lobbyist. His website, Abramoff.com. Jack Abramoff, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I never thought I'd say that. I spent a lot of years trashing you on the air, and I thought yeah. You were the poster boy for corruption in D.C., and I hear you condemning, and rightly so, politicians who are on the take,
yeah.
But I haven't heard you condemning lobbyists who are making this happen. In fact, you brag about how for the $80 million you charge, you delivered $6 billion worth of value to corporations, hustlers, rich people, Indian tribes, whatever. Shouldn't that be illegal also?
Oh, absolutely. I the only reason I think you haven't heard me bashing the other side is maybe you just haven't heard the other shows. I mean, I've been absolutely after what I used to be honest
okay.
with you.
All right. Well, in that context then, there were people who were involved with you in what you were doing, and I'm curious what happened. You said at one point that you had 100 members of Congress in your pocket. Why is it that only one of them went to jail, Bob Ney?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, obviously I wasn't deeply in the room with the FBI and the Justice Department as they made decisions on who to prosecute. But I do know that some of the rules that the Congress has created for itself and some of the precedents that they have make it very tough to go get them. For example, the speech and debate clause, I think you remember the cash and Congressman Jefferson's freezer at home. If that freezer had been in his office, he'd still be enjoying the cash. So I know that they've had difficulty in terms of speech and debate clause and other things, but you know, I wasn't in the investigations and you know, in terms of decisions and what they were doing. But
well, if you have the information on you know that could cause other members, for example, John McCain did not call Ralph Reed to testify before the Senate. Ralph Reed was part of your you know, several of your schemes, actually. He was in Scotland with you and with Bob Ney. He was in a secret partnership with you that screwed the Indians, and Ralph Reed made a whole pile of money off it. Why did John McCain not call him to testify, and why didn't you rat out Ralph Reed?
Well, first of all, I didn't. I answered every question I was asked by investigators. I didn't rat out or not rat out. They had 850,000 emails I wrote, so they hardly needed, frankly, to even ask me questions. But everything that Ralph did and everybody else was in front of them. In terms of McCain, that's a very curious question, to be honest with you. I fully expected him to be called and was quite stumped when he wasn't called. So,
do you think that it might have something to do with the fact that members of the Bush administration and, you know, other senior Republicans, but specifically House staff, White House staff from the Bush administration were regularly eating and drinking at your Signature's restaurant on your dime, and that Tom DeLay was eating there and that Karl Rove was eating there and you were paying for it?
Well, first of all, I didn't pay for Karl Rove when he ate there. He paid himself, but, you know, they didn't have
Are you hesitation. Sure?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That I'm certain of. But in terms of, they didn't have any hesitation bringing me up there. I owned the restaurant, not Ralph. As to your very good question about Ralph, I just don't know the answer to it. But nobody had any compunction about dragging me up there.
But were other staff members of the Bush White House eating at your restaurant on your dime?
On my dime, no. The folks in the Bush administration, the actual executive branch folks that I knew, were very careful not to let me treat them there. I can't say that that's true, by the way, for other lobbyists who ate there. Don't forget, I wasn't the only one who ate in the restaurant.
Sure.
I mean, it was a big restaurant. We had people both who worked for me and people who didn't work for me availing themselves of it. So I can't say for certain about them. But the very few people that I dined with from the Bush administration, they were very careful about that.
Okay. You put $1 million into Ed Buckham, who was the ex-chief of staff for Tom DeLay. Why wasn't he charged with anything, and why wasn't Tom DeLay charged for his involvement with you?
Well, again, I can't answer why people weren't charged. I know I was charged, and
right. If the Republicans were protecting all these other folks, and it's certainly looks that way to me, and you know, feel free to reality check me on my
sure.
conspiracy theory here. Ralph Reed seems to have been protected. Ed Buckham seems to have been protected. It was basically like, you know, they decided to throw you and Bob to the wolves. Why?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I don't know about the upper echelons of the Justice Department and what decisions were made. I can only comment on the people at the lower level, the prosecutors and the rest I work with. I don't think they were out to give anybody a pass based on politics. But again, the decisions, you know, as to where things went.
They had to work with what they were given.
Yeah, but you know, they did a very thorough investigation of 2,000 people, by the way. And I have to tell you, there's as good a question to ask as well about the Democrats. I mean, I had Democrats
sure.
who worked for me, and, you know, I had a bunch of congressmen and senators who were Democrats who got plenty of money from us. And, you know, the Bush administration, maybe in their clumsiness or their ineptitude or whatever, allowed the scandal to be completely seen as a Republican scandal. It was a bipartisan scandal, and, you know, it was bizarre to me. But, again, you know, I wasn't privy to that.
When Reagan came into office, my understanding is that there were a few hundred lobbyists in this town, and now there's over 10,000.
Yeah, at least, right.
Yeah, and I've heard numbers as high as 38,000 if you
yeah.
consider people who are like Newt Gingrich, who, you know, take $1 million from Fannie Mae, but doesn't call himself a lobbyist.
He's a history professor.
Yes, exactly. So between lobbyists and history professors, there's a whole pile of them in this town, and there's a hell of a lot of money, as you
right.
well know, and as
sure.
I've noticed the year that I've been living here. And how do we put an end to that? You know,
yeah.
particularly given the Supreme Court's position that money is speech.
Yeah, I think that there are a few things that I write about in the book, in Capital Punishment, in terms of how to go after this stuff. When I was sitting in prison, frankly, you know, obviously after I was done and on the floor, I stopped being a lobbyist and stopped being politically partisan in the sense of I'm not beholden to anyone anymore. And so I started writing and thinking about, you know, if I were still a lobbyist, what are the kind of things I would try to stop? Because the kind of reform they usually do, nobody cares about. It's actually a joke.
Right.
So what are the things I would stop? So the first thing that I say is we've got to absolutely go after the money, as you mentioned. The fact that people who are lobbying the federal government are getting things from the federal government, special advantages, the stuff that makes people mad, the stuff that puts people on the street for the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement and all the rest, this stuff has got to be stopped. And I think one of the ways
How?
To stop it is take the money away from the congressmen that are coming from these special interests. Make it so that if you are a lobbyist or you are somebody who's lobbying or hiring a lobbyist or hiring a strategic advisor or whatever the euphemism Newt and the rest of them use, you can't give any money politically. Zero. Not a
But then they get around this with 527s. You've got the Koch brothers setting up.
We've got to get rid of that. I mean,
okay, well, but the Supreme Court says you can't do that.
You know, for the corporate speech, we're going to have to find a way to do it, whether it's a constitutional amendment or whatever. But I got to tell you, and Tom, I know you see this. People are just pissed off about this.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
So would you support a constitutional amendment that says that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech?
Well, I think it's got to say a lot more than that, to be honest with you. There's a lot more problems here.
But if you did that, then you could pass the laws that you're talking about. Right now, the thing that is impeding those laws is the fact that corporations are considered persons and money is considered speech. You blow those things up, and then you can start passing laws stopping the revolving door, stopping the buying off of members of Congress, et cetera.
I agree, but I think if you go for the constitutional amendment, you've got to go for everything you need at once because it's a very difficult process. As you know, look how often they amend the Constitution. You know,
very rarely. Yeah.
So if you're going to go for it, I think you've got to put together a comprehensive package that's going to stop all of this stuff. And by the way, attack as well, to some degree, the speech and debate clause that keeps these guys from going to jail when they perform all sorts of shenanigans up on the Hill.
So the speech and debate clause in the Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've got to go after the things that they're using and they're taking advantage of.
That is creating immunity
not
for them, essentially. It's the reason, essentially, why they can do insider trading right now.
Exactly. And the fact that they make laws that don't apply to them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an outrage.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Jack Abramoff, his website, abramoff.com, his new book, Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. Jack, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. Very, very interesting. We will be back. It's Anything Goes Friday today. But I had to get Jack Abramoff in there. I thought that was interesting. We will be back with your calls on pretty much anything. I got some news to share with you, too. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Like, for example, the economic numbers, the unemployment numbers. There's a good side. There's a good news and bad news right after this.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with the Anything Goes Friday. Just a couple of quick ones. The Muslim Brotherhood, you know, the Fox News is all hysterical about this. And by the way, the Josh Marshall over Talking Points memo started back in August talking about the Murdoch primaries. And how Rupert Murdoch basically defines who's going to be the Prime Minister of England, who's going to get elected, which political parties, because he has so much media power in the UK. And now with Fox News in the United States and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post, he has so much media power in the United States. At the very least, he can define who's going to be the Republican candidate for president. And so keep an eye on the Murdoch primaries. But anyhow, Fox News and the other Murdoch empire, you know, one of the things that they use is fear. And in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood took about 45% of the vote. Yeah, they 40%. They took 40% of the vote. And a ultra-conservative party, the Salafis, took about a quarter of the vote. Now, the Salafis, the ultra-conservatives, Muslims, are sort of, it's a very, very imperfect comparison. But in Christianity, they would be like the fundamentalist Baptists, or in Judaism, they would be like the Hasidim, you know, arguably, you know, they're the most religiously conservative. And the reports that Fox News has been putting out is that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is basically kind of a middle of the road sclerotic old organization, started out a bunch of, you know, people bent on hellfire and brimstone, and Al-Qaeda spun out of that, but that was like 30 years ago. And nowadays they just want to be the establishment, you know, anyhow, Fox is saying that, you know, there's 40% for the Muslim Brotherhood plus 25% for the Salafis. That's, you know, 65%. And holy cow, the secularists don't have 65%. Don't worry about it. The Muslim Brotherhood has issued an announcement saying, you know, they're not going to cut a deal with the Salafis, to do, you know, wackadoodle religious stuff. That Egypt is going to continue. That is going to be largely run along secular lines. So, anyhow, FYI. And meanwhile, the Republicans' efforts to crash the economy are, you know, so far still working. We'll see where it goes. Unemployment just dropped 8.6%. That's the good news. 120,000 private jobs created, you know, employers hired people around the United States. That's the good news. You know, some organizations are growing. We just hired somebody last week. That's the good news, right? Our show is growing. The bad news is that a large reason why the unemployment rate dropped from 9% or 8.9, I think it was, down to 8.6, is that a couple hundred thousand people said, I'm not looking for a job anymore, or their unemployment benefits ran out, or they just said, that's it. Or they'd been unemployed so long that the government considered them no longer looking for a job. But when you look at the number of people who really probably would love to have a job or who are underemployed, it's 16% in the United States. We're in a Great Depression right now. And any attempts to do anything about this in Congress are being stymied by the Republicans, who are convinced that if they can make the economy bad enough over the next 12 months, that the voters will blame Barack Obama for it and elect Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney or you know, whatever, you know, Chris Christie, if he comes right, you know, whoever gets to be Marco Rubio's running mate. They're going to elect that person. We'll see. And frankly, you know, as bad as Mitt is and as bad as Romney is, in terms of, well, I can give you 100. If a fresh face who is the, you know, who is viewed with a largely positive perspective, like Marco Rubio is the running mate, the Republicans actually will have a chance, a serious chance. So I would take this very, very seriously. Anyhow, 866-97-THOM. Let's get to anything Ghost Friday here. Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on AM 1350. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. The trouble with staying on hold so long on your show is that 100 new things pop up that I want to talk about.
Okay.
So I'll try to
pick
remember.
One. We're doing one topic a person today.
And I woke up too late to talk to Senator Sanders, but I want to thank him for explaining why he voted against it. It's the best reason in the world. But I have an idea.
Okay.
With this payroll tax. Right now, at $100,000, after that point, nobody's paying a dime into the payroll tax. So everyone talks about raising the ceiling. Well, what about this? You want to help the poor? Raise the floor. Raise the floor so that the first maybe $20,000 does not get taxed. Raise the ceiling, that same 20%. Raise it to, and even maybe graduate it down. So
yeah, raise it up to $250,000.
Yeah, I mean, well, exactly. I mean, and it doesn't have to be at the same percentage. Everybody who's making more than $100,000 doesn't feel the same exact pinch.
Yeah.
But the people at the bottom who really hurt by this, the first $20,000, take it away. That affects everybody. The first $20,000 of everybody's income doesn't get taxed. And then you graduate it at the top, or you do something like a financial transaction tax with
sure.
Wall Street. I mean, everyone's forgetting about Wall Street and apportion some of that.
Well, hang on just a second. That's where you lost me. I think the idea of raising the floor is intriguing and excellent, actually. You know, the people on their first $10,000 of income or their first $20,000 of income, you know, which is all a lot of people make, and it's not enough to live on in the United States anymore. They should not be paying 6% or 7%, almost 7% Social Security tax on it. On the other hand, when they retire, they do get Social Security, and you do want them to be able to say, I paid into it. And I think that's the argument against raising the floor. But it's still an intriguing idea. But it could work in the direction of trying to make it seem like a welfare program. I think we just need to raise the cap. It's just really simple. Just say, you know, Bill Gates is going to pay the same Social Security tax as everybody else, and apply it to capitalist gains income as well as to regular ordinary income. Mike, thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, think about that for a minute. Capitalist gains, capitalists who make their money sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the check to arrive, they don't pay any Social Security taxes. What?
What you gonna do on Judgment Day? Time to run out now, and you can't stay. Screaming and crying, you got to go. Heaven, St. Peter, won't you open the door?
Yes, speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. That was an interesting conversation with Jack Abramoff. Getting Jack Abramoff to come out in favor of ending corporate personhood. That's kind of cool. Anyhow, anything goes Friday. Lee in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Lee, what's on your mind?
Hi. I called you so many times, but my deal is, to my heart, I watched C-SPAN on Wednesday. The House of Representatives passed a bill to arrest anyone in the world, including the United States, without representation, if they might be connected with terrorist activity. That means they could arrest me indefinitely, and I wouldn't be able to call anyone as to my whereabouts, and they could construe anything I might do, as March with Wall Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
Example, Martin Luther King. You know, I just said I did call my senators to support the Utah Amendment. Is this McCarthyism at its worst? Will Obama veto it?
I think, you know, is Stalinism at its worst. Lee, the Senate tried to make the bill better when they passed it yesterday by adding an amendment that got a 99-1 vote, I think, or maybe it was 93-7, but whatever it was over 90% vote, that said nothing in this law shall be, and this is my best recollection from memory, so this may not be literally word for word, but it was something like nothing in this bill shall be construed to change existing law on the status of prisoners, you know, of what do they call them, detainees or whatever. And so what they were, and what Harry Reid said in the press release that he sent out last night, I read it when I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, couldn't get back to sleep, and so I'm reading Harry Reid's press release to put me back to sleep. And he sent out a press release saying, you know, this bill is still imperfect. It still has to be reconciled with the House bill, so there's still going to be another opportunity to cycle through the thing. But it does have a piece of legislation in there that says that the Senate, at least, is not taking the position that you just characterized, unless the existing law already says that. And nobody's really sure what the existing law says because it hasn't been vetted yet by the nine kings of America, also known as the Supreme Court. So Harry Reid's comment was, in his press release, was, we're going to leave, you know, the Senate is not going to decide this. The Supreme Court is going to decide this. Well, if you've listened or watched my show long enough, you know that I have a huge philosophical problem with that. But nonetheless, that's how American government works right now. And so I think that they've walked back that language in the Senate, but there are still several more acts in this play. There is the Senate bill and the House bill are different, and which means that they have to go to what's called a conference committee where they reconcile these two bills. A bunch of senators and a bunch of congressmen and women get together, and they come up with a bill that says whatever both bodies find acceptable. Then both bodies have to re-vote on the new bill that's the identical bill, because, you know, you have to have identical legislation in both bodies. And then when both bodies have passed it, then it goes to the president and he can sign it or veto it. And he's threatened to veto language that would basically turn America into the battlefield and let anybody be arrested. So we'll see, I guess, is the answer right now. But don't let up the pressure, Lee. You're doing the right thing by contacting your legislators. Keep doing it. Every single one of us, unless you're in Washington, D.C. like I am, every single one of us has two senators and one member of the House of Representatives. That's three people to call to say, not to mention the White House, and the phone number for the White House is 202-456-1111. That's their comment line. And all of this you can find, and Congress is also available. I don't have that number right off the tip of my tip of my brain or whatever, tongue, but it's at callcongress.org. You can get that. And so, you know, call them. Let them know what you think. Send them an email. Particularly if you live in their state or if you live in their district, let them know. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. Larry in Kalmar, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I'm still working on my PhD from Tom Hartman, you.
Me too, Larry.
To your viewers, this last month I pledged $10 to Free Speech TV.
Good on you.
I think I'm going to send them $20. My budget will allow it.
Okay, good on you.
Abram Hoff was great. I thought he called all the backroom deals and the money that's buying our Congress shenanigans.
Yeah.
I've been calling them that for years. I always thought C-SPAN should televise the shenanigans that are going on in the back rooms rather than the empty floor of the House with, you know, some...
I'm still trying to figure out Jack Abramoff because, you know, essentially he made his living as a con man, and my sense of it is he still is to some extent. And, you know, on the other hand, sometimes con men can do good stuff. You know,
do you think he's had a change of heart, and do you think that other guys will fess up if they go to jail?
I don't know. The fact that he didn't drop the hammer on Ralph Reed on this call makes me think that maybe he hasn't had a change of heart. He's just had a change of employment. that he can no longer make a living as a lobbyist, and so now he's going to make a living selling books and his and getting a speaker's fee and trying to be the anti-corruption guy, but he's still not going to trash his old buddies, because Ralph Reed, in my opinion, is, and, you know, just from what I've read and what I've seen, and, you know, Ralph is welcome to come on this program and rebut that, but it seems to me like, you know, if Bob Ney went to jail, Ralph Reed should have gone to jail. And Tom DeLay and Tom DeLay's associates. And if Jack is saying he's got 100 members of Congress in his pocket, why did only one go to jail? I mean, I think that there's a bunch of things there, but we'll see. We'll see. Larry, thank you for the call. And, you know, very much appreciate the call. Maria in Windsor, Vermont. Hey, Maria, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just called because I missed Bernie, but I didn't know if they're aware of, like, with the fuel assistance. What goes on with that? Because when they send the fuel assistance to people, they don't send them enough to even get the minimum.
Yep.
Gallons.
It's interesting. And Bernie mentioned that, I think, briefly in passing in the first, you know, his little 10-minute rant when we opened the show. And I know I talked with him on the phone just before we went on the air about it. It's called the LIHEAP program, the Low Income Heating Assistance Program. And the LIHEAP program has been cut by about 40% by Republicans over the last few years.
They don't even give enough to get the minimum gallons required by the fuel company.
That's right. That's
in
right.
Order and to order, so you can't even use your fuel assistance.
Right. Well, you could use it, but you've got to use your own cash along with it.
If the people are on fixed incomes,
yeah,
like a lot of the elderly are,
yep,
or the disabled, they are.
Bernie is all over this.
Extra cash.
Maria, Bernie is all over this, and I would strongly say, if you have any questions about it, call his office. You're one of his constituents.
I wonder, because they require 125 minimum gallon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, they won't deliver.
You're in Windsor. I think probably his closest office to you would be Burlington. You know, call his office in Burlington and, you know, find out. He can get the details for you. And also ask, the other question to ask, Maria, when you call is, what else can I do to move other members of Congress? Because Bernie can't pass legislation all by himself. And the LIHEAP program's funding needs to be restored. Maria, thank you for the call. Go for it. You know, good on you for doing that. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Abramoff took you down the road, and you mean well, and you have good intentions. And by your tone, it told me that you're sincere. And he is slicker than butter on a hot roof in Florida in the summer.
Well, that's what I just said a minute ago, Armin. I said, you know, he was a con man then, and I think he's a con man now, and he's just changed his con.
Let me tell you why, specifically. And then I'd like to talk about Newt Gingrich, if you give me enough time, please.
Well, there's a whole bunch of other people waiting in line, Armin.
Okay, where he danced you down the road is he wanted to load, you wanted to keep it simple, stupid, for the people out there that can, that have been brainwashed by Fox and the media and the neocons and all the other instruments out there that the powers that be that have money use day in and day out repetitiously. You need to keep it simple so it's a real black and white contrast, and that's what you wanted to do. And he kept taking you from that and says, no. If we make an amendment change, we got to really load it down and do it right.
I know, and I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. You don't, and I didn't want to get into a debate. But no, Armin, I got it. And here's the thing that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to get into a debate with Jack Abramoff about the fact that you can't legislate, you can't create laws with constitutional amendments. Constitutional amendments are broad principles. After you've established the broad principles, then Congress passes the legislation. So, you know, Abramoff either doesn't understand that or he wants to screw it up. I don't know which it is. But the fact that he would at least agree that the system is so screwed up that we need a constitutional amendment, you know, that was kind of cool. Sean in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Tom, I was really excited to see that you interviewed Morris Berman on your Great Minds series.
I did, yes. And he's been on this show a couple times, too, over the years.
I'm really looking forward to checking that out when I get down to the library to use the internet. But I bought a copy of Why America Failed, and I've already got a copy of Dark Ages of America and A Question of Values. So I kind of was hoping that you'd riff a little bit, Tom, on Morris Berman and his whole concept of the hustling society. I think I part company a little bit with Morris Berman when it comes to
children.
I do too at a certain level, and let me do that when I come back from the break, Sean. Thank you very much for setting that up. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Morris Berman and the Hustling Society. I'll explain what Jack was talking about in just in about 5 minutes. Just stick around. Indeed. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. And this is where I part company with Morris Berman. Morris Berman has been on this program a number of times. He's written a series of books about America basically being in crisis and going down the tubes. And he got so depressed about it that he moved to Mexico. He left the country. And we had him as a Conversations with the Great Minds. You can see it over at conversationswithgreatminds.com a few weeks ago. And where I disagree with Morris Berman is, you know, he says, you know, America's a nation of hustlers, and we always have been. I think there's some truth to that, but that's true of pretty much all of Western civilization. And, you know, Mexico is no panacea and no paradise either. I believe that it's better to stay and fight and participate and be the change and be part of the change than to stand on the outside and throw stones. And I think I'll just leave it at that in my rant about Morris Berman. In fact, what we should do is probably get Morris back on the program, and I can debate him about this. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining me on TV last night.
I'm delighted to.
You are brilliant, and
thank
you did
you.
Such a great job. So, what's up?
Well, there was a meeting in the Capitol basement this morning of Republicans, House Republicans, and Speaker John Boehner referred to the latest package that they're going to be introducing to extend the payroll tax holiday after both the Senate bills went down, and called it turning chicken bleep into chicken salad.
Little Boehner powerful. Said that?
Boehner said that.
He's going to do that by what? Is this the Keystone Pipeline thing that he's going to throw in there?
That's right. He's going to pave the way for the controversial Keystone Pipeline. He's also going to ease environmental regulations on boilers, sell broadband spectrum. He's going to freeze the members of Congress pay. He's also going to change federal employees' pension rules and freeze their pay.
So this is not making it into a chicken salad. This is making it into something very dark and oily. I'm trying to come up with something. What's that awful Scottish, was it haggis, brains and things, blood pudding, whatever?
You are being very rude. We're getting to the season. December the 31st is when we pipe in the haggis.
I thought stomach. Yeah, indeed. But I don't think that this is chicken salad. I think
no,
it's something
but
darker.
The Republicans do. They think that they can force it through with these softeners, but it may not work. It may, but it may not work. There are some Republicans who are still opposing it, but they really hope that they can whip them into line.
It's more like spam. You know,
it's spam.
You have some idea what it's made out of, but you're not quite sure.
Yes, spam.
Or Wonder Bread.
Yes, Sam.
I wonder what it's made of.
Bread. Oh, yes, that never goes off.
Right, right.
Or if it does go off, it doesn't turn green like normal.
Right,
it goes red.
Yeah, I still have a loaf of Wonder Bread left over from when I was 12. It has, you know, it's still fresh.
Very scary.
So
apparently, at this meeting this morning, frustration was evident. Asked if Boehner's leadership team misread the conference, Representative Jeff Flake of Arizona said, "Yeah, I do. I just think they're wrong."
So this was Republicans talking to Republicans,
yes.
And it blew up in Boehner's face.
Yes, but many of them went along with it. So the thing is, they were hoping to get them all in line so that they could push this through because they want the payroll tax holiday.
Right.
It's not clear at this point whether everybody's in line. So this is really interesting. This is in the House.
So where is
Senate,
excuse me, before we leave the House,
yes.
Where is the guy who's got his hand on the knife that is always just pricking the skin on the back of John Boehner, just right above the left kidney? Eric Cantor, where is he on this?
Yes, I want what I want when I want it, as his yearbook photo says.
Yeah. So where is he on this?
Right now, he's right with John Boehner on this.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yes, right. Because they've both seen the polls that show that the American people want millionaires and billionaires to be taxed a little bit.
Okay. So, but they're not going to do that. They're going to figure out something else.
Right. They want to figure out something else because so that they can actually extend the payroll tax holiday because they know that that Americans want 116 Americans are going to benefit from.
Right. Here's the amazing irony. If they extend the payroll tax holiday, in other words, they give a tax cut to working people, and they pay for it by cutting the environmental regulations and doing the XL pipeline, they're actually increasing the wealth of the top 1%, because that pipeline and those oil companies are owned by the Koch brothers and billionaires and whatnot. And rather than it's not that they're not raising their taxes, they're going in the opposite direction. They're increasing their wealth.
Fascinating.
Yes. So anyhow, you said over in the Senate.
Well, then, of course, over in the Senate, it was a disaster last night for the bill because it failed twice. So we'll have to see how they negotiate to come up with something that's going to pass. That's what's happening in the Senate.
Right.
Meantime, the next thing up, of course, is the wrap-up spending package, which they have to figure out the spending for all the different government departments before the end of the year, which they haven't done.
Right. And oddly, the end of the government year is October. Is it October 1st or October 31st?
They're doing it for 2012 right now.
But this is because we're living by continuing resolution.
Exactly.
We're living by 3-month budgets. And so this 3-month budget expires on New Year's
Eve.
December
16th.
On December 16th?
The next continuing resolution expires on December the 16th.
Oh, interesting. And that's when they're
hoping. They don't have much time.
Right. And so that's when they're hoping to leave for Christmas. But
that's when they're hoping to leave for Christmas. And in fact, they're sort of saying to the conservative freshmen, you can leave for Christmas if you get this done in 2 weeks. But if you're difficult about it, like all the conservative riders that you want, you can't. And of course, Planned Parenthood and all these other things are being attached to the omnibus spending bill. And so we're going to see once again exactly what we've seen before.
You mean defunding Planned Parenthood?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So very, very interesting. So there's going to be another hostage-taking situation, or at least another crisis?
I think it's going to be similar to this. What I think we're going to see is probably that we're going to see another continuing resolution until February, probably.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. They'll kick the can down the road another few months.
And then they'll all go home.
Yeah, and then they'll go home and on the paid taxpayers' dime and have a fine old time. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Self-Empowerment, Ellen Ratner's new book. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, this is very entertaining. Rick Santorum says that health insurance companies should discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions because they're going to be more expensive. I thought the whole idea of insurance was distributing risk over a broad base. You know, as I recall, it was E.F. Stone largely invented this concept back about a century ago. When I was in my 20s, I used to read stuff that he wrote because he was one of these big kind of motivational guys, and he had these, you know, do it now buttons and posters and stuff, and he was kind of a hero of the self-help movement. And his idea that he built into a multi-million dollar insurance company was, if you can get a large enough number of people to pay a little bit in, then when a few people, you know, you're always going to have a few people who are going to get sick or who are going to drop dead. When that happens, then that risk is distributed over a broad base, and it doesn't wipe you out. In fact, you can make a small profit at it. Make a small profit on every single person. You make a large profit altogether. You become a multimillionaire, which is what E.F. Stone, if my recollection is correct, it's rather old now, but did. But Ricky Santorum just did a town hall where he said, no. People with pre-existing conditions, they should pay more for health insurance. Tell me this isn't crazy. Tom, in Hot Springs, Arkansas, Anything Goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you. I think you're the smartest man I know.
Thank you.
I wanted to
probably not,
share with
thank you.
No, I think so. Anyway, earlier this week on Wednesday, I believe, you had a guest on from Lung Cancer Leaders,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to share a story with you and your viewers and listeners about an experience I had with the disease.
Mm-hmm.
About early October of this year, my wife was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Oh, my.
She had never smoked a day in her life, and we were all shocked of all the diseases we thought she could have ever contracted. That would have been the last on the list. She took care of herself. Anyway, within 30 days, we lost her. She was only 63 years old, and I just think that the people need to know lung cancer can kill anybody.
Oh, yeah. And well, the guest I had on, either herself or her mother, I think it was somebody in her family, was a non-smoker who was diagnosed with lung cancer, stage 4 lung cancer, inoperable, and
yeah.
was dying at that point. And that provoked the creation of that organization. So, yeah, that's an important message to get out there. 1 in 14 Americans, that was the statistic that came out of that interview that blew my mind, was 1 in 14 Americans will be diagnosed in their lifetime with lung cancer.
Right. And then another thing that struck me is that the survival rate is like 15%,
yes.
and it's been that for decades.
Yeah, it hasn't significantly changed since the invention of surgery, because there's basically, you know, it's hard to catch early, because by the time it's showing symptoms, it's usually, you know, metastasized and gone nuts.
That's exactly what happened to my wife.
Yeah, and B, even when it is, unless it's caught very, very early and can be surgically removed, they don't have good chemotherapy agents for lung cancer. And so,
right, exactly right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to share that with you all and let you know that, you know, it's something that we need to do more research on.
Yeah, okay, well said, Tom. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to the show. I appreciate it. Peggy in Craftsbury, Vermont. Hey, Peggy, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much. I think you're the closest thing to 99% radio that we have ever had. Long
Thank
before
you.
99% got to be.
Maybe we should start before. Calling it that. Here we are, the 99% radio. We say talk radio for the rest of us.
You know? I have an idea, and I'm also sitting here with my copy of Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals, which
mm-hmm.
you probably know well. And this is the idea. I'm a member of the Progressive Party here in Vermont. We don't take corporate money. But what I'm thinking is that there are so many of us, and there are more of us than there are of, quote, them. What if there were candidates who declared themselves to be 99%ers who do not ever take money from any corporation? After all, the major parties want to buy our vote. If we declare that we are not buyable, if we declare we will not vote for anyone who is backed by a corporation, do you think it's realistic that we could populate the Congress with 99%ers? I feel that there's enough of us spread throughout the country, millions, who would respond to a 99%er as a candidate.
I think that if you look at, for example, Elizabeth Warren, you know, exploding in the polls in Massachusetts right now.
Right.
You know, Dennis Kucinich being reelected over and over again. Bernie Sanders. And Bernie, by the way, is going to be in for a hell of a fight this year. He's up for reelection in 2012. And his website, and he's not taking corporate money to the best of my knowledge. And his website is Bernie.org is the campaign website if you want to help out his campaign. And the problem is, it's not so much the candidate in this post-Citizens United world. It used to be that if you gave money to a campaign, say you had a Democrat, a Republican, and a progressive in the state of Vermont, you got the Progressive Party, you decide which one you're going to give money to, and you do, and it gets recorded and it gets published, and it's a matter of public record. That's law. But now with Citizens United, if somebody wants to come in and say, knock out your progressive candidate, Anthony Polina was his name?
Right.
Yeah, Anthony, who I've met several times, who ran for governor, yeah. and a great guy.
He's now a senator.
Oh, he is. He's a state senator.
He is. He's a senator, but he ran on a DP ticket.
God bless him.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's great. Yeah. Because he, you know, and you know, you've got some. There are good politicians out there, and Anthony is one of them. And so, anyhow, my point is that if somebody decides that they're going to take that person out, they no longer have to give money to the opponent. So it could, both candidates, both the Republican, the Democrat, and the Progressive Party, they could all say, we're not taking corporate money. Because what happens is the corporate money goes into the 527. It goes into these, you know, it goes into Karl Rove's global GPS or whatever it's called. And that money gets spent on ads that trash the candidate or build up a candidate. And it's invisible money. It's unaccountable money. There's no way to know how much was spent. There's no way to know where it came from. This is the product of our Supreme Court, and it's what it is why we need a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech, and to stop the legal protection of those things and the legal protection of this kind of behavior. Because even if you had, you know, perfect candidates on both sides, anybody could come in and flip that race. And it's just, it has become insane, Peggy. It has just become insane. Politics has become insane, and it's moving us, as Bernie pointed out today, it's moving us in the direction of oligarchy. And the only remedy to that, and this is why Bernie is preparing to co-sponsor the beginning phases of a constitutional amendment in the Senate. I believe it's already been introduced in the House, to say corporations are not people and money is not speech, to go beyond just rolling back Citizens United, but just go right to the core of this thing, right to the heart of it, to corporate power. And you can read my book about this, by the way, online for free over at truthout.org. The book is Unequal Protection, that we need a constitutional amendment to do it, because it's not enough. You know, it doesn't matter what the candidates say anymore. You could have candidates who are just absolutely wonderful or absolutely terrible, and it doesn't matter what they say, because if some billionaire decides that they want them elected, whether it's a friendly billionaire or a hostile billionaire, whether it's a progressive billionaire or you know, then that person can define the race, you know, or a multimillionaire or a big corporation, and it just shouldn't be that way.
I couldn't agree more with everything you said. The problem is that I don't want us to be limited. And I know what happens here in Vermont. We've got three parties, and frequently the progressives don't run a candidate against the major candidates because we don't want to create, you know, a vacuum.
The way to fix that, Peggy, is with fusion voting like they have right across the river there in New York State or across the Lake Champlain. And fusion voting is where you can run as both a progressive and a Democrat, for example. But anyhow,
this
Peggy,
is the Tom Hartman program.
We'll be back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Rio, listening to us on our iPhone app in Clemente, Singapore. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Singapore, yeah.
So you work there?
I'm working here. And paradoxically, I left the U.S. under its greatest modern depression to portray one of the greatest American Depression-era characters, Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, interesting. So you're an actor.
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, good on you. That's an art form that I have a lot of respect for. So what's up?
Thank you. I'm a journalist. I was a journalist. Mm-hmm. I'm also a writer. Mm-hmm. My biggest question, to give you a quick background, 10 seconds. I'm a first-generation American-born intellectual. My parents did not reach high school, and I was born in the U.S. I had all the most amazing opportunities that anybody could ever have. I had scholarships. I went to Juilliard, etc. Mm-hmm. I've also been an activist my entire life. I was at the WTO protest in Seattle. I was in New York. I was at the FTAA protest in Miami. I've always found myself to be more of an autonomist over an anarchist. And at every protest, I really did feel beaten down and literally bruised and beaten down by the system itself.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, now in this time of an amazing upheaval, the greatest upheaval in the last, I don't know, 50, 60 years of the U.S., not to slight the civil rights movement, but this is bigger than the civil rights movement because we have surpassed and achieved what the civil rights movement has wanted to achieve. And so we're here.
Now we're here.
Well, if we can, and I don't want to make your job feel obsolete after this, but if it were to be achieved, a resource-based economy would essentially destroy lobbyists. It would destroy the idea of a two-party political system. It would destroy the idea of what we have known our whole lives to be the governing system of our social...
What do you mean by resource-based economy? Are you talking about a barter economy?
Well, bartering, I mean, I can't tell you, like, Venezuela, like, just traded 18 tons of rice with Cuba's, you know, 30 tons of, you know, sugar cane.
Right.
I can't say that. But essentially, if you start at the local level, and California knows a lot about this. I moved from Miami to Los Angeles a long time ago, and that's the only reason I have this job in Singapore now. It's because the economy was so bad in Los Angeles when Obama became president that I took this job here on the other side of the planet.
Right.
That the local-based economy has a lot more to do with what builds an entire country. You start at the local level. You don't think nationally. You think about where you can walk to from your house to 5-10 blocks away and buy or whatever you need.
So you're really talking about a local-based economy, regardless of the medium of exchange.
Well, regardless of the medium of exchange, I, like I said, I was an anarchist at one point because I didn't have enough information. My IQ level is up to par with what can be a possibility. And the possibility, it really stems to what is possible. So,
sure.
I've seen it in California on a very small level.
Yeah, I saw it in Vermont with Green Mountain Dollars. You know, there are local economies in Vermont where you can only use the local currency with local stores, and it was their way of keeping people from that money ending up in Walmart, frankly. You know, and it worked.
An absolute throwback to the greenback.
Yeah.
And essentially, we can incrementally, from town to town, create these moments in society where the economy itself becomes the people.
Yeah.
So the people are not governed by an economical structure, say, like the federal government, where it prints a bunch of useless pieces of paper that they add value to.
Right. Well, it's not even the federal government that's doing that. It's the Fed. The federal government isn't merely authorizing them to do it, and the Fed is a private corporation owned by private banks, which makes it all the worse. And it can't even loan money to the federal government without it going through private banks like Goldman Sachs, and they get to skim a piece off the top, and that's a bizarre law. But,
It's the skimming that's the problem, because the U.S. economy has actually imperialized or colonized the entire world's economy. I mean, if the U.S. economy or the U.K. economy were to crash, and they're going to crash, if they were to, say, in the very near future, it would affect the entire planet's economy.
Well, this is what happened in the 19-teens, is at that point in time, the UK, the British pound was the world's default currency, and the British government was the largest empire on earth. And coming out of World War II, the British government was in tatters, and the pound was no longer the default currency. And that was the whole point after World War II of Bretton Woods, was to make sure that the U.S. dollar would become the world default currency forever. And but there was that period between World War I and World War II where there was a lot of, you know, nobody was really certain what was going to happen and which currency was going to come out of it because the Depression was hitting everybody so badly. But for 100 years prior to the 19-teens, it was the British who ruled the world as empire and as reserve currency. And when the British pound crashed, it was the best thing that could have happened to the United Kingdom. you know, it took a generation to wring it out, but it ultimately was the best thing that could have happened to the UK. And I believe that we are watching the deleveraging of the United States. We're watching the US dollar cease becoming the world's currency. And I don't think in 10 years the dollar is going to be the world's default currency. Or maybe it'll take 20 years. We'll see. And it, a lot's going to depend on whether the euro can make it through, and a lot's going to depend on what happens with the yuan, you know, the Chinese currency, the renminbi. So we'll see where this goes. But Rio, you've opened a whole lot of interesting questions. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we have done programs where we've had on people who are specialists in how to create a local currency. There's a whole movement for this. We're going to have to do that again. I'm putting that on the list. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very proto-genally ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for the brain, the good, Nick Hannanauer. Nick is a venture capitalist who helped start up a number of companies, including Amazon.com, so needless to say, he's in the 1%. But he doesn't think like a typical 1%er. Yesterday, Nick published an op-ed in Bloomberg Businessweek, decimating the myth of the job creator and calling for more taxes on rich people like himself. Nick wrote, quote, "We've had it backward for the last 30 years. Rich business people like me don't create jobs. Middle class consumers do. And when they thrive, U.S. businesses grow and profit. That's why taxing the rich to pay for investments that benefit all of us is a great deal for both the middle class and the rich." End of quote. Well said. Not only if we can get our lawmakers on board with this simple economic premise. The bad. Gretchen Carlson. The beauty queen turned GOP TV talking head was debating unions this morning on Fox and Friends and threw out this convenient little piece of misinformation saying, "Some would say that it's the unions that have crippled the U.S. economy and led to the United States debt." By "some would say," Carlson must be referring to her colleagues on GOP TV. Forget the fact that the Bush tax cuts, the wars, and the financial meltdown caused by banksters are by far the largest contributors to our debt. Any war requires misinformation, especially the war on unions, and Gretchen Carlson is doing her part. And the very, very ugly, the American Family Association. The right-wing religious organization just released its naughty or nice list praising companies for mentioning Christmas in their advertising and criticizing companies that fail to mention Christmas enough times in their advertising. Topping the nice list is the American Family Association's own online store. How humble of them! Along with companies like Kmart, Lowe's, and Sears, all using the word Christmas frequently and thus considered Christmas-friendly. Making the naughty list are stores like Barnes & Noble and Victoria's Secret that only use the word Christmas sparingly in a single or unique product description, but as a company do not recognize it, their phrase. You know, the companies that are declaring war on Christmas. But shouldn't it be the opposite? Shouldn't companies that exploit Christmas, one of the holiest days of the year, just to sell more junk we don't need, be considered naughty? I guess according to the American Family Association, honoring the birth of Jesus is best done by buying and selling stuff. And that's very, very ugly. Think about that for a minute. That's a very, very strange paradigm, whatever. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, let's talk about lung disease and how it affects 1 in 14 of us. Brings up a very important point.
Mm-hmm.
Our singular focus on climate change has made us forget about other pollution issues. Mm-hmm. That even if climate change weren't true, they're still important. And besides, dealing with them will help alleviate climate change anyway. And so, like, if you look at lung cancer, I know you've been directly affected with your father and your good friend Dennis Weaver.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
People need to realize lung cancer is probably one of the major human-created diseases around. It was uncommon before we started smoking. It wasn't even recognized as a separate disease until 1761 when the Industrial Revolution was just taking hold.
Yeah, although it was almost certainly happening before that, but not as frequently.
It was a very low amount.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is that burning fossil fuels, burning coal, burning oil, produces what are called high fraction hydrocarbons that are carcinogenic and that are airborne, and you inhale them and bingo, you put a carcinogen in contact with lung tissue and eventually you get lung cancer.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, radon gas is another huge thing that unfortunately sometimes as you make a house more environmentally, you know, more energy efficient, you can actually trap radon gas in there.
Right. A lot of that has to do with where you live in the country and whether or not you're on top of a granite formation and how well you vent it and things. But, yeah.
But living in cities, I mean, if you look where lung cancer occurs, it occurs where there's lots of air pollution. It does not happen in rural Africa and so forth, unless, of course, people are by some industrial site.
Yeah.
But it happens where there's concentrations of cars and where around industrial sites.
Yeah.
And really a thing caused by us. But while we're talking about, you know, climate change, we cannot forget we have many, 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 many other environmental issues we should concentrate on, too.
And these are, and here's the biggest of all the big pictures, Jeff, and this is the one that the Republicans in Congress, who are defending the oil company and their $6 billion a year subsidies, will not talk about. And that is that lung cancer, many cases of lung cancer, and millions of cases of asthma, are what are called externalities. They are the cost. They are a cost associated with burning fossil fuels, and the fossil fuel industry does not pay one nickel, not one penny of those costs in the United States. Now, in Denmark, the fossil fuel industry has to pay. You know, the gasoline refiners, for example, pay an extra about $1 a gallon. Gasoline is more expensive in Denmark than in most European countries because they take that extra dollar per gallon and they use it to fund part of their national health service because they're saying, hey, you know, you're gonna drive a car which is going to produce exhaust, which can give people cancer or asthma, then you're going to help pay for the treatment of that cancer and asthma.
Yes, and not just the burning of the fuels, but actually obtaining of the fossil fuels, too. If you look around fracking sites and so forth, the drilling sites,
yes,
people live nearby report all sorts of respiratory problems.
Yes,
so in Pennsylvania and Colorado and you know all around the country in Arkansas.
Yep,
these you know just obtaining the fuels, the whole thing about tar sands.
Yep,
and which brings up also another thing in obtaining these fuels. People don't talk about the great water usage and the incredible water pollution that occurs.
Yes, another externality that they don't pay for.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
that's basically an irreversible problem too.
Yeah, if you're depleting a slow replenishing aquifer, it's absolutely the case, and that's very, very much happening in the United States and in fact all over the world. Jeff, excellent points. Thank you for calling. You always have some of the most insightful thoughts. Larry in Victoria, British Columbia. Hey, Larry, what's up?
LivingDownstream.com, Dr. Sandra Steingraber's incredible film about carcinogen abolition based on the precautionary principle. Jim Dean.
Mm-hmm.
You know he chairs the Democracy for America Get Out the Vote School.
Right, democracyforamerica.com. He's Howard's brother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The very practical information there is something I think we all need to learn to get around Citizens United before we're going to get candidates elected who are non-corporate candidates.
That's a great suggestion because they have this democracy school. Well, actually, the democracy school is the thing that David Cobb is doing. But what Jim Dean is doing is these activist trainings. I forget how they're branding them, but it's the democracyforamerica.com trainings. And I went through one. In fact, I spoke at one in Portland some 6 years ago or so. And they're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant. They basically teach you how to be an activist, how to get active. And it's not purely party politics. In fact, it's not even largely party politics. It's mostly on the ground organizing, you know, around issues and the things that you care about. Excellent point, Larry. And, you know, thank you for calling and making it.
And mention how to increase voter turnout is at the website.
At the website at democracyforamerica.com.
You got it.
You got it.
How to increase
voter
turnout. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Much appreciated. Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Well, you put me in mind with you're talking about the war on Christmas of my confirmation class, which happened when I was 14, so that was 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the minister said, you know, if any of you grow up to own stores, please promise me that at Christmas time you will only play secular songs, Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. He said, don't play the Christmas songs that we sing in church. He said, please don't use Jesus to sell things.
Wow. And here we have, I think it was the American Family Council or whatever it is. Jacob can check it. Yeah, American Family Council. They've come up with this list of naughty and nice companies, and they dislike the companies that do what you just described that your priest said to do, and they praise...
Well, he was a Reformed Church of America minister, not notably liberal,
okay,
but he was a Calvinist.
Yeah, and they are dissing, and they are praising the churches that are quite literally using Jesus to hustle goods. And, I think one of Jesus's sayings was something to the effect of, you cannot love both God and mammon, right? God.
And when I worked for Oxford University Press, we did a strange promotion for the release of the complete New English Bible. Mm-hmm. I was singing in folk singing at the time. And so they arranged that I would sing in the window of Morehouse Barlow, which was an Episcopal bookstore just off Fifth Avenue, for this. And I said, well, okay, but I won't sing the Lord's Prayer. I will only sing songs of conscience.
Uh-huh.
I won't sing religious songs to sell anything, even the Bible.
Wow. That is a very principled position, Judy.
Well, I felt that way. Now, we did get an... I gave them an escape clause in that if somebody requested something, I would take a request and sing for a person.
Sure.
But there's plenty of songs of conscience out there that Jesus would agree with.
Yeah, there you go. Well, he was the original protester. I mean, he came into
Absolutely.
The temples and flipped over the money changers' tables. That would be the equivalent of occupying Wall Street.
Right. He did not hang out with the wealthy folks.
That's right. And isn't it amazing that, Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and in fact, Frank Luntz is basically saying to these people, the meme that you want to put out, the story you want to put out about the Occupy Wall Street people is that, they poop on the street or they need to get a bath or that kind of thing. And those are the people that Jesus hung out with. Those,
yeah.
The homeless, the infirm, he healed the sick. The Occupy Wall Street people are setting up these clinics and tents and medical tents, and they're healing the sick, and they're being trashed mercilessly on Fox News and on right wing talk radio by people who call themselves virtuous Christians. It's mind boggling. Judy, thank you for the call, and thank you for the reminder of what real spirituality is all about. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is 45 minutes past the hour. Back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out our pre-live chat room at TomHartman.com.
You have it? I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, who's running around like a chicken. He's doing so many things today. To our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Julie Lule, to our screener and researcher, Paul, our writer and researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for our video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at our syndicators, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others around the country, to Monica Ashvi, Dennis Trunov, Don Rojas, and all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercott, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Sincerely, thank you. Let's see here. Bill in Connellsville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Yes, I'm calling about a pharmaceutical. It was put on the market in 1958. It was just recalled a year ago. As early as 1978, Ralph Nader was telling people that it was a dangerous drug and it should be taken off the market. They knew for all those years that it was a dangerous drug. The drug was Darvocet, okay. And what it did, it would knock people's heart out of rhythm, and then that causes a myriad of problems. A lot of people died. They say that this drug may have caused more deaths and injuries than Fen-Phen, which was one of the biggest,
That's incredible. Darvocet was, if I recall correctly, a painkiller that was stronger than the NSAIDs and weaker than codeine.
Yes, uh-huh.
And so it was sold as a low addiction potential painkiller, and the set part meant that it had acetaminophen in it, so it was also partly Tylenol, basically, along with the Darvon.
Yeah, that's correct. In 1993, I was healthy as can be. I was 31 years old. Suddenly, I took some Darvocet. I got very sick. I ended up with heart disease in a hospital, almost died.
Holy cow.
Okay, all these years since, I've been on disability. I live on less than $700 a month. I don't want pity here, but I go to the doctor every month for, I have to take blood thinners. I've been through, total hell for 19 years, just staying alive. I've been
is there any, I remember this drug because my mom had back surgery when I was a kid, and that was the painkiller that she was taking after her back surgery. Or one of the, after the strong ones that weren't being used, after the first couple of weeks. And she took it for a few weeks, and I just, I remember it. But do you have any lawsuit options? People who are damaged by Fen-Phen or people who are damaged by Vioxx can participate in these class action lawsuits. Is that available to you?
Well, in 93 when I had it, they didn't know what caused it. They did every test they could think of, and they just had no idea what, caused all this heart disease. Even though that back then I told them about the bad experiences I had and that everything started right after taking Darvocet.
Wow.
Well, then all these years later I found out, that was the truth. Now, it was proven that after 2006, that they knew for sure when the Eli Lilly company sold it to Xanodyne Pharmaceuticals that it was killing people, that they kept it on the market. So maybe the people before 2006, like me, I don't know where we're going to get, shelved or whatever.
Wow. But I would be doing some aggressive Googling with this one, Bill, and see if you can find somebody out there who's these companies need to be held to account for this. Bill, I got to move along, but thank you for
one more question, real quick.
Sure.
Here's my point. Why is the people that covered it up never exposed, never arrested? If I killed hundreds of thousands of people, injured thousands of people, I would be arrested. I would be exposed. My name would be on TV.
There's a very simple answer to that question, Bill. The very simple answer to that question is because they're rich. We have a two-tier justice system in this country. If you steal a candy bar, you will go to prison. In some states, if you steal a candy bar three times in your lifetime, you go to prison for life. On the other hand, if you steal $100 million working for a bank and you're a multimillionaire, you not only do you not go to prison, but you'll probably get a bonus. And that's just the horrible reality of the American criminal justice system is that it is not just. And that the very wealthy people who control these companies and who make these decisions virtually always get off. And the one thing that holds them accountable are people are basically personal injury lawyers. And who hold them accountable? People like Mike Papantonio, for example, go out and sued the tobacco companies. That's the one line of defense we've got. And the Republicans want to get rid of that with this thing called tort reform. And the whole goal is to put those lawyers out of business. But I think you need to find a good one. Just my personal opinion. Thank you very much for the call. Good luck, and I wish you well. Sam from Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Sam, you came through your cancer surgery okay. We got 1 minute to go in the show. It's all yours. How you doing?
Okay. Professor Hartman, I'm reporting to you about my cancer treatment. All right, first I want to say there's room for Jesus and Frosty Snowman at the same time in our country. Jesus knows his children. Now, getting on to my cancer surgery, it was successful. They got it all out, but there's a couple cancer cells floating around there, and they put a port in me today. And the doctor said he's going to make a model patient out of me because I'm a healthy cancer patient because I eat all them fresh veggies. So anyways, after I get the chemo and everything run through me and get rid of that other cell, I'll be cancer free.
Okay, well, good on you, Sam. And the next time you call, turn the TV down a little farther. great to hear from you. Good luck. God bless. And you are in my prayers. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. We will be back on Monday, and I've got, here it is. It's time for the War on Christmas. Brian Fisher, the American Family Association, speaking of, is it time to occupy Christmas? And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you get active. Get out there, tag, you're it, occupy something, and have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.